Well, first of all, I ask by email if you're fine with exams end of February, early March. It's not by no means, it is not the only slot that we can do. It's just quite natural, especially that some other people want to have exams then anyway. So, do you have any strong preferences? We can do anything from early February until, I know, late April or whatever you want. With some exceptions, but for the time being, is it okay to look at end of February, beginning of March, roughly? Of February, of the exam session. Well, February, first week of February, it's. Yeah. Well, the only problem that I see is House of Gabba. I'm not sure if Christoph is. Planning much for actually next week is supposed to be demonstration of skate tool, so probably the deadlines will be all over by now, and I think that he will manage to check whatever there is. So from my point of view, actually, it's not a problem. I think that the earlier the better. I will double check with Christoph and I will let you know. Anybody else who has preference for exams early? Anybody else who has strong preference for exams later than early March? Okay, let's keep it then the way it is, and I will come back to you about possibility of doing it first week of the exam session. Evaluation, two people, I don't know if anybody return it after Monday, but on Monday they send me an email saying that two people submitted evaluation forum. So if you still want to say bad things about me, by the way, there is one person missing. This was the most useless lecture I have ever taken. Then you have opportunity to do it so anonymously still until 4th of February, if you remember. And I wanted to announce courses our chair will have next semester. Ideally, of course, this is done next week, but I want to make sure that I will not forget already, so I preliminarily mention it now. Oh God, I have too many tabs open, but I don't even remember where our own chair was. But for the time being, instead of electronic version of the poster for next semester, I can simply point you to teaching next semester, and most of these lectures already have some sketchy form of web page. Some of them are, of course, obligatory, so this is not what is of interest for us right now, but Model praktische Semantik von Programmiersprachen, this is the one that I mentioned several times regarding COC and proof assistance rather than fully automated techniques like model checking. And if you want to see a natural continuation, extension, or complement of the material I'm presenting here, and also how one works when one does not have just to guess all the assertions and annotations before throwing it at the tool, but actually playing a kind of tango or a game where you try to lead the tool towards the right proof, and the tool is simply disposing of all the trivial cases as you go on, and helps to focus on the important parts of reasoning. This is precisely what the use of general purpose proof assistant is. The Model Logic course by Daniel Hausmann. It's a relatively new course, but already last year it was quite popular for a good reason. And we have seen a specific form here in, of modal or temporal formalism, namely in form of namely in form, Model Logic, namely in form of temporal formalism like CTL or LTL. And this course starts with the very basics of simplest possible model formalism and builds it up to very powerful systems like fixed point calculi, which can do much more than even CTL or CTL star. can express. Similar homotopy-type theory. Well, this is for those of you who probably it's much more interesting or useful if you already had some exposure to to proof assistance or dependently type programming languages, and you're interested in ins out of formalizing, say, mathematical proofs, more complex mathematical proofs in proof assistance, like Coq or maybe something newer like Lean. If you ever have some experience already with Coq, AGDA, Lean, also dependently type version of Haskell, like Epigram, this may be also something you want to have a, you may have a look at. And algebra of programming, lecture which was done, I think, only once in the past by Stefan Milius this semester, and the next semester is going to be done by Lutz Schroeder, which was, at least in first edition, also popular for a good reason. But maybe I will wait for it saying more until we have poster. So poster is already available in hard copy. You can see it probably in many places across the campus. Next week I may have also electronic version of that. So these are the courses that, if you're interested in any aspects of what I was talking today, you can have a look at. And you would be more than welcome. If you survive this long in FMSoft, you are more than prepared for any other course that we are doing. Also, of course, if you're interested in any projects, be it master project or master Arbeit, or bachelor, if you're still a bachelor student, for whatever reason, then I'm always more than willing to accommodate, and possibly not only myself. I'm trying to keep a reasonably updated list on our chair website, but there is always possible to come up with something new which works better for you. In fact, as I said, even formalization, there is even formalization of separation logic, which I'm quietly using here in Coq, which was developed as such a master project. Right, so these are administrative things. Now to return to matters at hand, we were still not completely done with separation logic and our extended dynamic form of IMP. We came up with this idea, or we briefly introduced the idea of having annotated programs, and you probably saw the similarity of what you're actually writing or preparing as input for very fast, let's say. Obviously, trivial way to introduce it would be to say you have to write precondition, postcondition in front of every command, but this is a bit too crude. This is not what we are doing, because of course then you would write, if this was the grammar that we are giving, then it would mean that you have to write maybe a bit more annotations that is typically necessary. So in order to define it in a, with the syntax of annotated program with a bit more flexibility, we propose detailed syntax in the way we saw in the last 10 minutes of previous lecture. So in particular, of course, if the command that we are talking about is sequencing, for example, then all those concrete programming construct in this in this grammar are already coming with postcondition being annotated at the very end. So, of course, there would be a postcondition here, and of course there will be postcondition here. Only in commands like conditionals and while loops, we need to put, let's say, body of and precondition from the body of the loop, or precondition in front of then and else branch, and then we allow ourselves to add general precondition, let's say, in front of entire annotated program, and if they happen to bump, let's say, if you write two preconditions in a row, or a postcondition of the previous command bumps into precondition of the next one, then we really understand it as and notationally render it as a place to apply consequence rule and suitably reflected in our notation. And annotated or decorated partial correctness assertion is simply obtained by writing this general precondition in front of annotated program. I'm just making the final postcondition explicit by writing this B at the end of C, but as we said, the grammar is defined in such a way that there will be always such a postcondition at the end of our annotated program. Let me double check, because we have always one late student. Maybe I'll keep that wrong. But... So, obviously, each annotated program can double as ordinary program simply by erasing all the postconditions and all the assertions that we put in its body. The definition is so obvious that I don't insult your intelligence with explicit inductive definition, which of course you have to write if you render it for a proof assistant. And then using this erase function, we can have our first stab at explaining what would it mean for annotated program to be correctly annotated. Well, kind of crudely, but the very least that we would expect of correctly annotated, sorry, not the program, but correctly annotated partial correctness assertion of this form, where this CB is annotated program and A is just a precondition for the entire thing, is that if you erase all the assertions in the annotated program, leaving just the final one at the very end, and you write this desired general precondition for the whole program, then in our proof system it should be derivable that this is indeed syntactically and semantically and even axiomatically valid Hoare triple. And in order to provide some kind of input for, let's say, automated tool model checker or whatever, which can which could decide this kind of question, we define a function which is extracting verification conditions. This is where the name VC comes from. This is a verification condition. So given a assertion of a separation logic, this intended precondition of the entire thing, this A, and annotated dynamic command, so a program of dynamic imp, we are extracting a probably quite long and messy another assertion of, but just an assertion of our separation logic without actual program code in it anymore. So this is this syntax of extended logical formulas with conjunctions, disjunctions, quantifiers, and those spatial connectives, namely special spatial connectives, namely star and magic wand. This is what SEPAS contain. And the trick is that if we have some tool that is able to reason about validity of such beasts of our separation assertions, and we have defined already formally what it means for such an separation logic statement to be valid, this should entail that the entire program was correctly annotated. So here all the intermediate assertions are eliminated. They were only used to generate this long and complex verification condition. And in this way, this separation logic statement, which we obtain by extraction of verification condition, is broken into small, smaller pieces, and while the entire thing which is joined by conjunction is a long conjunction of wild things, wildly looking conjunction, if you look at each of the conjuncts separately, it's much more tractable and natural to handle, because in fact the way those conjuncts were generated were straightforwardly inspired by basic axioms and validities of the kind that we were discussing in last two lectures. So this is sounding a bit abstract, but I already started doing it last week for the standard IMP program without dynamic constructs. Let's see again how it was supposed to look like. So given this general precondition for the entire program A as the first argument for this function extracting verification conditions, and annotated program where the final annotation, final postcondition of entire thing is this B, how do we extract it for each of the standard IMP, for timing without dynamic part, just ordinary IMP the way we have seen it in late November and December. Well, starting with skip, annotated with some generic postcondition B, the verification condition to extract from this pair of arguments is simply that in order for a program A skip B to be valid, implication A to B must be valid. In order for a program annotated with precondition A and then assign A to X and check if B is valid, well, we need to check if the implication from A, from this precondition, to B, where all the occurrences, did I fix it? Because last time I messed it up. No, now it's the right order. So now I'm replacing program variable X with arithmetical assertion A, right? And you see how this extracted verification condition is directly inspired by the basic axiom that we had for assignment. Similarly, for sequencing, in order to extract verification conditions for the sequence of two annotated commands, one of which is of course ending with B. Now we are making this first condition of the second of the first of them explicit. Well, we first need to compute verification conditions for where this A, the precondition for the entire program, is the first argument, and the left side of semicolon is the second argument, and form a conjunction. So we see how we produce more and more conjunction of things while generating those verification conditions, with verification condition for the right side of semicolon, but now we use the B, which used to be post-condition of the first command, as the precondition for the second piece of code. So I, in order to make it even more explicit, I could write this special brackets B prime here, and just to make clear that because of the way those annotated programs are defined, C2 of POSQ, we also have some final purpose condition here, but it is not playing any concrete role in the definition of verification condition for sequencing. For if then else, for conditional, well, now we need to write something larger, because we have no guarantee that it was prudently annotated, right? So it is, these annotations are written by us, by human beings, and of course we want to help Framasi or VeriFast or whatever we are writing, or ADSL, whatever we are writing, ACSL, not ADSL, whatever we are writing those annotations in, as much as possible. So we want, for example, what we write as precondition of then close to be simply well, maybe even equivalent to the conjunction of the precondition of the entire conditional with the guard of the loop, but at the very least implied by it. And similarly, we want the precondition to Well, this is what we need to check then, no matter how different syntactically those two things are, this A conjunction B and A1. And we also need to check that the conjunction of A with negation of the guard somehow implies what was written as the precondition of course, L Sprach. And then you remember the shape of the rule for conditional. We remember that we had two premises, one premise for then branch, another premise for else branch, and the postcondition occurring in both premises was one and the same. It was supposed to be this B, right? So now we need to, in order to make sure that this program was indeed correctly annotated, we need to check that what was written as the postcondition of then branch and postcondition of else branch is indeed equivalent to what is suggest, so what the person writing annotations to this program suggested as the postcondition for the entire conditional, both then branch and else branch, right? And then, of course, we need to proceed inductively by checking if inside then branch and inside else branch annotation has been done correctly. So a lot to write, but if you take it conjunct by conjunct, and if you look, if you compare it with the, what we established about validity of Hoare triples and axioms or rules for each of the program constructs, you see that this is just straightforwardly reflecting those rules in combination, of course, with consequence rule. And similar things happens with and the rule for the annotated form of the while loop. So first of all, what is being proposed, first recall that the rule was saying that I'm not sure how visible this is. Now I'm writing P instead of A and B, whatever. I hope you can handle this much of notational inconsistency, but this is how the rule look like. So now if you compare what we see here with what is I should have written it also for the conditionals, but hopefully if you lost, you see, will simply remember to get back to the December slides where we introduced the rule for conditionals and put them side by side or print out just that slide and look again at this thing. So now let's do it just for the while rule. So we remember that we see by comparing the extracted verification conditions with the form of rule for while that presumably the thing that we write as intended postcondition for the body of the loop for the one single step execution of the body should be somehow related to what was written as the precondition of the entire while loop conjunct negation of the guard, and this is indeed reflected here as third conjunct of this extracted verification condition. Right. Similarly, if you compare this A intended A1 intended precondition of just one iteration of the body of the loop with A, which is intended to be general precondition for the whole while loop, clearly it has to be related to conjunction of so the precondition sorry the, it is the first conjunct that I'm supposed to be looking at, so the precondition of the entire while loop is supposed to be somehow related to the so here we are incorporating also consequence rule in fact, I should write in order to pattern match it better with what is on the slide. I should write A1 in prime here. And then, of course, we also want to have that this thing is valid. Right? And then we could use consequence rule here in the derivation. And then the way precondition of the body of the loop or one iteration of the loop is related to the but the way precondition and postcondition are related is this. They are supposed to be only differing by the fact that precondition is conjoint with the guard of the loop. And the postcondition of the entire thing is supposed to differ with the postcondition of the body of the loop simply by conjoining it with negation of the guard. And then we, of course, have to proceed with our extraction of verification conditions inductively by checking that the one-step iteration inside itself is correctly annotated. Is the idea now a bit clearer behind the whole thing? So this is something that we could have done already in December before we introduced this idea of spatial connectives and frame rule and dynamic constructs. Let's now see how to translate the rules that we obtained for perhaps already directly starting with global backwards conditions, the global backwards specification for dynamic constructs. So this was the global backwards condition for allocation. And again, the verification condition that we write for annotated program starting with some precondition A is the obtained by combining this thing with consequence rule. So A should imply what this global backwards specification that we obtain tells us should be valid before execution of allocation. And we proceed in the same way with mutation, lookup. This where, if you recall, the condition, especially derivation of lookup, is something that we spent quite a lot of time last week. And the allocation. So what happens in all of these cases is we take the global backward specification and combine it with precondition part of the consequence rule. And then you remember that we could also write a precondition in front of a new precondition in front of annotated program, which was yet another application of consequence rule. So then we need to proceed with the latter, the second precondition, as the with extraction verification conditions, and add one more conjunct, one more implication to the extracted verification condition. And similar thing happens when we write a new postcondition. And now, to make it even more obvious notationally, I'm adding this implication arrow from the old postcondition, in the old proposed postcondition to the new one, which is, of course, typically added in order to help pattern matching with the next program construct when we sequence two commands. That's how it looks like. It's not really intended so much for human consumption. It's more intended for a tool which is given an annotated program and tries to find if it was correctly annotated. We will try to quickly go through a relatively easy example in the next slide. For timing, let's state the theorem that we wanted to have. So if this long conjunction that we obtained by extracting verification conditions from annotated program is indeed valid, then it means, well, I could have written here, of course, double dash, but I can even say it more. In fact, we can Well, what matters is just the double dash thing, this hor triple is semantically valid. But because of soundness, this is a stronger way of stating this. Then, so if the long conjunction of extracted verification condition indeed is logical validity in this logic extended with new connectives, new spatial connectives, then it means that hor triple obtained when you look at the notated program as ordinary program and the main pre and post condition is indeed a valid hor triple. And I think that the description that I gave you, how you, or that I suggested, how you obtain those verification conditions following or trying to parrot the combination of axioms and rules for each of program construct, combined with consequence rule, show how inductive proof of this theorem should go. And of course, this means that we need to ensure, if we want to use this kind of result and this kind of annotation technique, we need then to ensure that the tool like Framasi or VeriFast that we use has as many tactics or heuristics for those verification conditions as possible, and that the notations that we wrote are helpful enough, and you have more experience at this stage than I do, or at least more freshly burned in your mind how painful it can be sometimes to tweak those annotations in the right way. By the way, if I state the theorem this way, when here I'm taking the program where all the annotations were erased, apart from the first and the final one, do we have any chance that implication also goes in the other direction? Any bets? So, and let's not complicate our life with writing this single tensile. So let's say that I'm writing double tensile here, right? So if I'm saying that this triple is semantically valid, does this mean that this holds as well? Yes?
I would say no, as this would imply that any annotation would be valid.
Right. Of course, we are just humans, and unlike the extraction of wicked preconditions that which was totally automatic, and this is something that we described earlier, now we are talking about annotations where we have a lot of freedom how to choose them, including freedom to make stupid choices as usual. And we may take a program which is a perfectly sensible, which is sensibly written in its own right and properly chosen general pre and post condition, but write some cretinous combination of false and true in the middle between assignments or whatever, in such a way that this thing can never, this long conjunction has some intermediate conjuncts which can never be true. So. And in fact, I think this you probably have enough opportunities to see that this can very well happen even when you are not stupid and when you're doing your best efforts. So typically, when you're struggling with these automated tools where you need to give lots of hints in front of annotations, between 20 to 40% failure to verify annotated code is the fault of the tool itself, because it's not powerful enough to handle all meaningful annotations or things which we obviously is to be logically valid. But more than half of cases, sometimes much more than half of cases, is due to us not realizing that actually what we wrote is not correct annotation. Well, it depends. Your mileage will vary. So some of you may be better at this game than I was myself when I was trying to play with these tools, but I think it's pretty general pattern that our annotations are never as good or as correct as they originally look to us, especially when we are annotating larger piece of code. For those reasons, people who are pioneering these techniques like Dijkstra, and Hor, they were insisting that program should not be, you should not start with having a large piece of code and then try to annotate it in order to see how it works and whether it does what it does. But from the very beginning, when you write it, you should already build it in a modular way from with assertions that that tell you clearly what this piece of code was supposed to do, and then there is much less room for error if you put this properly annotated or properly understood pieces together. But of course, this is a beautiful piece of academic theory, and real life may look very, very different. So just to have a quick look, I mean, as I said, this is not what we are supposed to do pen and paper, although, as I already mentioned, Dijkstra was verifying programs in precisely this way, using his fountain pen in, throughout all his life. But he was not working with Hor logic, but rather with extraction of verification with of weakest preconditions. So let's have a go at this very simple program, which is just allocating two memory cells with some absurd values and then disposing of them. And here is proposed, so we should have started without those parts in brackets, and this, the odd lines are our suggested annotations. Let's see if we can reasonably quickly see, if we can reasonably quickly convince ourselves that this program is correctly annotated. So we have here, fortunately, we don't have to start with conditionals or while loops, so we have just straightforward sequence of basic commands. And you remember what we were doing when we have sequencing, right? So we split it into two pieces. You take first verification condition for this thing, and then they take this thing to be precondition for the second half, and you extract verification condition for this, which in turn is done inductively. So first this part, right? So we have allocation, and you remember with allocation we were combining consequence rules, so taking the precondition proposed in our annotation and checking if it implies what should be the precondition of allocation according to this global backwards specification of it. Is this thing true? So what does this mean? Is it true that when our heaplet is empty, then whenever I extend it with a single cell, which is pointing to the value of 42, then what I obtain is something satisfying this predicate, meaning I am a single cell, this particular address, pointing to 42. And this is, I mean, we could of course prove it on the blackboard, but this is just immediate unfolding of the definition of this thing and of this predicate. So then we have to split the remaining part into two pieces, meaning we have the second conjunct have to has to take care of this part. So we already now are now with a world where one cell was allocated, and a cell which which is addressed by using a number stored by program variable X, and what is stored under that address, the value is 42. And now if you, so if we have a single here we have some number which is stored under X. You remember that we use stores in order to check what this number specifically is. And now the question is, if this particular heaplet consisting of just a single cell is such that whenever I add a disjoint, so something else this as, using as the address something else the, than this S of X cell, where23 is being stored, then I obtain something where 42 is pointed out by S of X and I prime is pointed out I by I prime. Again, these are trivial tautologies of separation logic. And then we have disposal. So we start with this thing as precondition, and this is supposed to imply what was supposed to be the precondition of the global backward specification of dispose X followed by this particular assertion or separation logic assertion. And in fact, if you look at the antecedent of this implication, it is obtained from the if you look at the consequent of this implication, is obtained from antecedent by quantifying away 42. Right? Remember that this thing pointing to on the line was exist I prime such that X point to this I prime. So this is trivial logical validity by laws governing existential quantifier, which you could take recall as just abbreviation, and of course monotonicity of this spatial conjunction in both arguments. And this thing, well, first of all, we quantify away what Y was pointing to, and we use the fact that this empty heaplet predicate is acting as, to use mathematical terminology, monoidal unit for this spatial conjunction. So we can always write spatial conjunction M, and we are not changing this assertion, really. So we obtain a conjunction of conditions which are written using this separation logic syntax, but in fact are very trivial logical statements, and each of them in its own right, and building even modest part of this separation logic proof theory, or even bunch implication logic, which is the propositional core of the separation logic, into our tool allows to decide verification conditions of this form. So that's on a very, very abstract level what is really happening. Of course, you wouldn't got very, very far if you, even in this simplistic programming language that we have, if you don't have at least one more major algorithm. Before I get there, maybe let's point out that before I was trying to, in December, I was presenting those annotated programs not using this grammar and the whole business of extraction and verification condition, but rather as a way of presenting derivation trees for core logic in disguise. And then in order we would need to, in order to keep those things reasonably close to those derivation trees, in order to pattern match exactly how the small axiom for allocation look like, rather than the global backwards condition that we are using here in this extraction verification condition, we would need to have this completely redundant conjunct with X equal to something, and X is always equal to something, but this I is not used at all in this post condition. So remember, we had this additional postulated derived rules in order to get rid of trash of this kind. But this is a digression that you don't have to pay attention to. What is much more important is that in order to annotate slightly more meaningful programs. We will need inductive definitions or predicates like list, trees, and so on and so on. And we have already seen this being done for even for the for the static part of INP when we were trying to annotate this factorial program, which was the definition of factorial I rendered using this long infinitary disjunction. And as we are going to see now, we can also encode predicate like list in a quite trivial way using such infinitary tricks. In real life systems, it can be non-trivial. So for example, if you look at Ilias tools based on separation logic like Smallfoot, which was probably the first thing that Peter Nohern and his team came up with. They provided support for very small subset of hardwired inductive predicates like list of trees based directly on the specific memory model that they were using with cells of this form, or for binary trees, cells of this form. If you remember, these were the motivating examples that I was using in the introductory lecture on shared mutable data structure. But already in very fast with its underlying dynamic, of implicit dynamic frames, you can write, you are free to write all kinds of inductive definitions, and you have tools to do proofs using them. And of course, you also have way of using arbitrary inductive definition or inductive types when you formalize separation logic or implicit dynamic frames using general purpose proof assistants like COC. And this is something that we may even have opportunity to see if you care to join for SEMPROC next semester. So how this is done? Well, let's start with this whole business of, let's not just start, but also end with lists. Well, end this part, because we still have at least two other parts of material I want to cover today. But just to get an idea, we want to define a predicate, or rather a sequence of predicates, where the first argument is telling us what is the length of the list that we are talking about, and the second argument being the integer supposed to be the first address of the linked list in question. And we want to now to define a sentence in our separation logic assertion language, which is simply saying that the heaplet is the linked list of length n, and its first address is z. And of course, there is some discrepancy here, because we define heaplets as being partial maps from natural numbers to values, which can be themselves integers, but here I'm using z as potential, as supply from which we take our potential addresses. But this is because, as I suggested, we can also use negative integers simply as very large supply of semantically equivalent null addresses. So how do you encode that you are list of length zero, meaning empty list, whose first address is z? Well, if you are the first address of an empty list, then you need to be a null pointer, right? So z needs to be negative. This maybe it's a bit confusing to use this abbreviation. This is what you should. Or we could also live in a world where we have integers or natural numbers extended with special additional constant null, and then z needs to be equal to this null, and the heaplet itself needs to be empty. Then how do you assume that you already defined what it means to be a list for your heaplet to consist exactly of, not just contain, but to consist exactly of a list of length n whose first address is some z or I prime. How do we define what it means to be list of length n plus 1? Well, now actually it's pretty handy to have this spatial conjunction, Because what I'm saying now is, okay, in order to be least of length n plus 1, you need to be able to divide our heaplet into two parts. One of them is just a single cell, again, pointing to some start, and this cell is the z, which is supposed to be new address of new first address of the entire list, and it's pointing to some I prime. And then if I look at the entire remaining part of the heap, so in particular, this already means that this I prime needs to be different than this z, because these are disjoint guys. Then this is a list of length n. Sorry, this is horrible typo. Now I understand why you look confused. Protest. So it should be list brackets n I prime. Such things are always ruining the effect. Sorry. I will correct it later. Then if we wanted to, we could define what it means to be linked list of some unspecified length, namely, well, infinite disjunction, or if we want to stay a bit more explicitly for unitary, we could existentially quantify this first n. This is clear, right? So this is, and then depending what tool you are working with, very fast, Coq, Agda, or any programming language where you have inductive types, you find it's straightforward how to turn it into inductive definition of a linked list. So I will not bore you further with breaking down this program into pieces, but here is, but actually if you attempt that after the semester or when you're trying a new proof assistant in order to encode separation logic, I can tell you this is an example that works quite well. So the, if it's reasonably decent formalization, it should go through your annotated program apparatus. There are, of course, dozens of other examples, but none of them works as smoothly as this one. And at the same, which at the same time is using already our inductive list predicate and is using proper iteration. So what this program is doing is, well, let's start with z being null. So this minus one is just to make it concrete, but if you have concrete syntactic null pointer, you would write z equals null instead. So then indeed, if you started with empty heaplet, then now indeed you can say that we have list of length zero, which is starting with a null pointer, because it's not pointing to anything. And now I'm having some, well, so this n is some externally given parameter. This is not, I should have written it in cursive letters rather than in this monotype font suggesting that this is piece of code. So this is infinite scheme of programs, one for every given n by external user. And what this program is doing simply is allocating n many cells with in such a way that each of them contains a pointer to the previous one. So we are creating simply an empty list, which then can be, we are not using much of mutation here, but which can be then later used to store some values. And this is indeed what the final annotation is saying, that we have a list of length n whose first address is this z that we keep modifying during the iterative, during the execution of the while loop to move further and further. And of course, programming language or implementer has complete freedom how to allocate those new cells. And again, if you look at the annotations, you see that they were carefully chosen in such a way that they stick as close as possible to the rules or to the verification condition principles. Yeah. Okay, so much for this. And now we can finally more or less part with the whole business of allocation, the allocation and dynamic programs, but I don't want to completely say goodbye for the next 10 or 15 minutes to Horlogic altogether. There was one thing that I kept promising to address for at least a month, and I never spent even those 15 minutes on that. Namely, I kept suggesting that it is possible to take slightly different approach to verification conditions, weakest precondition, the whole business of program annotating and automated rezoning, where we want our annotations or our assertions not only to ensure that if program terminates, that then it will satisfy our chosen post condition, but that we want to ensure that it does terminate, and then of course it satisfies whatever we propose as post condition. The question is how we adopt our systems of rules and our notion of weakest precondition to get the job done. And this is completely orthogonal to this business, let me say this again, of fault avoiding interpretation of whole triples that we see in dynamic setup. Oh, okay, I said beforehand everything that is written on this slide. So I alluded to this most explicitly 2 months ago when I mentioned this bottom convention for partial correctness assertion, where I said that when defining the notational semantics and the notion of validity of our triple, we assume that this non-terminating constant or bottom is assumed to satisfy any assertion whatsoever. And then the simplest or the most straightforward from formal point of view way of turning everything into from partial, switching immediately from partial to total correctness would be to say that no, now I want bottom to not to satisfy any assertion whatsoever, and then take the definition of partial correctness assertion the way it was introduced on of December 7. So I'm still saying that, but I'm writing in a slightly different way. So now I'm writing those square brackets. I mean, some people observe this convention, sometimes some people do not. And I'm saying now that A, precondition A, C, postcondition B is valid in exactly the same way, in fact, as I said it when defining the notational semantics for IMP and for Hoare logic, but with the difference that this is now this reading. So I'm saying that whenever sigma satisfy A, possibly if there are some meta variables, they have to be interpreted using this interpretation I, then it has to be the case then what our partial function, being the denotation of command C, does to the state sigma, satisfies B. Right? That this is what we say is the meaning of Hoare triple. But now, if this partial function here is undefined on sigma, then it means that this thing here is bottom, and then this means that this thing is never valid, even if this B is, I don't know, true, the constant true. So the only way to make such a triple valid then in our state in under this total reading is if the program or the if program C terminates and satisfies B. And then the question is, do we need to redesign everything? Or can we pinpoint exactly what needs to be changed or what is potential candidate for change in our proof system that we used to have? When we rewrite now using this new kind of bracket, everything using this new kind of brackets, in such a way that we have still meaningful Hoare style specification and sound rules. What do you think? Anything wrong with skip? Anything wrong with assignment? Anything wrong with conditional? Anything wrong with, well, let's say that we are, I'm living in a world where I also have those dynamic commands. Allocation, deallocation, of course what could happen is now that program tries to access something that it wasn't allocated. But as I said, we have separate part for the, in the definition of semantics, if we had proper definition of semantics for our dynamic programs, which is saying that interpretation of hot triple has to be fault avoiding. So in order for a hot triple to be valid, even when we're talking about this partial correctness, we wanted program to not to try to access parts of memory that is, that have not been allocated yet. So is there any problem anywhere? And if so, where it is? Well, there is just one construct, the obvious thing that we can use to construct non-terminated programs, and this is, of course, Wilder rule. So that's both in the definition of axioms and rules. This is the only one that we may have to change. And also in this whole business of extraction of weakest precondition, this is, which now will be not called WLP, weakest liberal preconditions, but just WP, weakest preconditions. And this is the only thing that needs to be modified. So, as you see, as long as we're doing this Hoare-style annotation business, that's not very nice. So why does it look the way it does, apart from the fact that those brackets look like whatever? So I'm putting now two additional arithmetical assertions here. One of them will be called termination metric of variant, and this AI, well, whatever. It probably has a name, I just forgot how to call it. Everything else, apart from the parts dealing with this AM, this termination metric, and is very much the same as it used to be for the Wilder rules in the past. So what we are saying here that if we start with this termination metric set to some value, it could be actually just some single meta variable, which is non-zero. We execute our command. Then we should end up with something which, which is still looking the way the rule for a while should look like. But in the process of execution, the value of this termination metric or variant, the thing that keeps changing while we keep iterating, should get properly smaller. Well, if we were dealing just with natural numbers, that would be enough. Otherwise, we need to make sure that at some point our power level does not become negative and we keep on going to infinite. So properly smaller, but we're still trying to hit zero. So there is something that keeps properly decreasing while we are executing our while rule. And then if we start then with this termination metric of variance being properly positive, there is only so many iterations that we can do before the program actually has to terminate. We cannot go on with this thing forever. Again, this only makes sense if we do some concrete example, and the simplest possible one would be Euclid algorithm of finding greatest common divisor. So first, let us define two predicates that I trust you know very, very well, and not from academia, but from much earlier part of our lives. So what that means for J to divide chi, K? Well, it means that there exists I such that I times J is equal to chi. Of course, all these things are natural, so to be integers. And then what it means for K to be greatest common divisors of I and J? Well, then it means that K has to divide I, K has to divide J, and moreover, for every K prime, that also has these two nice properties of dividing I and dividing J, it cannot be any bigger than this K. Right? This is exactly what it means to be greatest common divisor. Not much philosophy here, but it's nice that we can write these kind of things when we have quantifiers in the formal language, where we have quantifiers and Boolean connectives and basic arithmetical operations. So this is how the Euclid algorithm, if you recall, what it was, look like. As long as x is not equal to y, we keep subtracting the smaller of those two guys from the greater of those two guys. And it's quite notable that this very simple idea terminates and moreover produces exactly the desired output. This is of what our annotations are saying. Right? So if x is storing the value of some I and y is storing the value of some j, both of them being very positive numbers, then our postcondition says we should end up in the situation where y, well, or x, if we wrote here x instead of y on the left-hand side of the assignment sign. Actually, it doesn't really matter, in fact, because after we terminate execution of this loop, x and y will be equal. As long as they are not equal, the loop cannot terminate. And this the one and the same value is precisely the greatest common divisor of the original input. So how do we pattern match it with the suggested rule? This is how it looks like. It helps to have it in front of our eyes again. So we need to find a good candidate for invariant of this loop, and we need to find a good candidate for termination metric. What are the proposals? Have you seen this example before, maybe in algorithms class or whatever? Or? Okay, if you haven't seen, because I'm never sure to what extent those examples are used endlessly in every possible course on hot triples, precondition, postconditions, automated reasoning, basic algorithms, and so on and so on, then it's even better, because then we have to try and think ourselves now. So what is one thing that does not change throughout the execution of this loop? And maybe even using some basic arithmetics, we can actually show formally that this thing is not changing. The values of x and y keep changing. Moreover, the sum of x and y keeps changing, right? Obviously, because... So these are not good candidates for invariants. But is there something more general that can be said? Especially, so we also have this original values of A and J. So it's quite likely that, for example, the sum of X and Y keeps being smaller and smaller as long as we can make one more iteration, whereas I and J, and these are just metavariables and the sum is not changing. So, well, this is good candidate for a variant or a termination metric. This thing keeps getting smaller as long as we keep executing the loop. And this is the invariant. The greatest, even though we keep changing values of, well, at least one of them, of y, it's a good exercise to work out pen and paper, and it takes not even high school, gymnasium level of primary school, even primary school arithmetics, to convince ourselves that whatever used to be common divisor of the original input, I and J, is also common divisor, in particular the greatest of them, of this constantly modified X and Y.
You have to modify both variables, don't you?
No, good question. I don't think so.
The else part is a typo.
Sorry?
The assignment on the else part is a typo.
Oh, of course. What I meant. No, wait. If y is greater than x, then. No, wait. If y is greater than x, okay, maybe actually it means that I'm not going to cover at least the introduction to bounded model checking that I also wanted to do today, but it makes more sense to make sure that nothing went wrong. So what we are saying here, let me try to parse it. It's obvious we are saying here. So if y is bigger of them, then this, it's strictly bigger because this was the kernel of the loop, then this thing, this difference is a positive number. Otherwise, x is bigger and this difference is a positive number. And then you say that I should not store it in y, but I should store it in x.
Because
x is 2 times y, then this assignment changes nothing, and we have an infinite loop. Well, let's check it then. If it works properly, if I switch this y to x, you might be right, actually. So. I want to show that the premise of this rule is true. So GCD IJ equals GCD XY and X different than Y. And x plus y equal to, I don't know, some, let's use some fresh variable here, k. And I actually should have put probably also as part of this a that both x and y are greater than 0. So x greater than 0 and y greater than 0. This thing, of course, then implies that also x plus y, or our k, is simply greater than 0. And if I execute just this thing, the conditional inside the body of the loop, so if x smaller or equal than y, then y is equal to y minus x, else, as suggested, x, so this is the point of contention, x minus y, and if, and then after the execution, it should still be the case that GCD IJ equals to GCD XY, and well, now I don't claim it might not be true that this thing is true anymore, and then also it should be the case that X plus Y is smaller than this K, and this is what you claim can break down if I put Y here. So if x is greater than y, and y instead of x is said to be x minus y, so let's say that fix attention that x is equal to y plus n, for some n greater than 0. And now this is y plus n minus y, so this is just n. And then after execution of this, x plus y is x plus n, whereas here it used to be x plus y used to be, and this thing is of course the same thing as y plus n plus n, so y plus 2 times n, whereas this thing used to be, oh yes, you are right, yes, obviously, sorry. No, wait. This thing was used to be y plus n plus y. So this here, if I do it the way I originally, suggested with y being y equal to x minus y, we have that this thing is equal to 2 times y plus n. So what you're claiming is that it can happen that these two things are equal. If
n is equal to y.
Right. Yes. If n is equal to y, then these two things can be equal, and then we cannot claim that termination metric decreased. Whereas if I set x to be x minus y, then it means that x plus y is now n plus y, whereas previously it was 2 times 2 times y plus n. So if both of them were non-zero, yes. So here we have a guarantee that it decreases. Okay, so that would mean that we would need now to double check also if everything else is correct, in particular that this most important bit is correct when we replace this with x. It is. I'm convinced that if there was a typo, this was the only one. But as you see, you should never take for granted what I'm saying, and you should always independently verify it. Okay, good. Thanks a lot. We avoided a I had minor embarrassment. I avoided a major embarrassment in this way. But as you see, anyway, this is not. This is not a nice looking rule anyway. Nothing as clean as the partial correctness rule for while loops was looking like. So we have this definition, what is much better tailored for this total reasoning, and in fact the whole business of weakest precondition was originally formulated for Dijkstra in terms of total correctness, and even these days when people are talking about weakest preconditions, then mean weakest precondition guaranteeing total correctness. Let's first recall how it looked like before, when we had this infinite conjunction of things starting from the completely trivial condition for the while loop. And then we just wanted to make sure that things keep propagating their truth throughout iteration of the while loop, no matter how many iterations will happen. So if the loop has not terminated, if the validity of, if we still have to make one more execution because B keeps being true, then we have to make sure that the weakest precondition for the body of the loop and the previous assertion in the sequence holds as well. This does not ensure termination, but if we now remove this L and write proper weakest precondition, and instead of writing infinite the conjunction of things, I write infinite disjunction, a form of existential quantification over these natural numbers here, of a sequence of assertions which guarantee termination, starting from loop not being executed at all, right? So the simplest situation where this whole business terminates and B is true afterwards happens when when the guard of the loop fails to hold, and then the loop is not executed at all, and then the only thing that has to be true then is that B itself holds. Or it has to be the case that B is, so this is, if this n is set to 0, so n plus 1 is just 1, B is true, we can execute body once, but after this one execution, what we want to achieve by this one execution is that card is not true anymore, and of course B holds. Then we have loop which was executed exactly once, and it ensured what it is supposed to ensure. And if this breaks down, then we have to take n equal to 1, so this whole thing being equal to 2. We execute loop exactly twice, and after that we are in a situation where guard is not true anymore and B holds. And if you write infinite disjunction of those things, then you have weakest precondition ensuring that if at least one of these, if at least one of these disjuncts holds, then it means that execution of this loop cannot go on forever, and after execution, B will hold. So unlike the messy form of Hoare rule for while, of total Hoare rule for while, this is not much worse, or any more complex, in fact, than the form of the rule for weakest Ibera precondition. So Dijkstra's weakest preconditions are perhaps somehow more suited or more natural in the context of total correctness assertions, whereas Hoare rules are perhaps more suited for this partial reasoning. And now I'm already over time. It probably doesn't make sense to start five introductory slides of for panel model checking, especially that I would probably need to repeat anyhow at the beginning of next week lecture what I wanted to say now. So just to say it very, very briefly, next week I want to return to something that we completely left behind since middle of November, namely to model checking. Because there is one important bit of this entire theory. We were talking about automata and stuff, and actually, especially what Christoph did with tutorial with automata for LTL was actually quite complex. But this is not really how you can push model checking to its absolute limits, and it's not exactly what it's behind state-of-the-art tools, not only new SMV and new XMV, but a tool that we planned to cover in more detail, namely SKATE, but I think that in the end it's always taking several weeks before we start using it reasonably proficiently, so what makes more sense is simply if Christoph gives you one overview presentation tutorial, and I will give a presentation of the crucial part of cornerstone of model checking theory that is behind state-of-art industrial level like tools, symbolic model checking with specific focus on bundled model checking, where instead of doing model checking for temporal formulas, you play a bit of magic and you somehow replace the temporal logic formula by ordinary propositional logic formula. Again, long conjunction of things, but now these things are just ordinary Boolean conjuncts, and somehow instead of checking correctness of model or diagram with explicit transition, given as, I don't know, adjacency matrix and talking about automata, you again in the world that such solvers can handle. So it would be also a good opportunity to wrap your minds back, maybe even as a kind of early overview for the exam of what was happening during the first 5 or 6 weeks or so. And fortunately, at least managed to cover what I wanted to cover today about leftovers of Hoare reasoning, not just separation logic, but also total correctness. So, see you next week.